Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm Will Seaman. Wael Elassadi will be back for next month's program, but this morning there's not much need for live hosts in the KABU studios for our show, and indeed this entire program is pre-recorded, so we won't be taking phone calls. This week we have a lecture, a presentation by Jeff Halper, the director and co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Jeff Halper spoke here in Portland last Saturday evening at the First Unitarian Church. The title of his talk was Between Solutions for the Conflict in Israel-Palestine. In the program, you'll hear Jeff referring to some slides, usually to maps of the region of Israel and the occupied territories. You can see these maps at the OFFR website, Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, at www.auphr.org. And these references to the settlements and to the areas A, B, and C were actually also the topic of last month's One Land, Many Voices with our guest Peter Miller. So again, the maps that Jeff is referring to in this lecture you can find at the OFFR website at auphr.org. So without further delay, here is the director and co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Jeff Halper.
As the world becomes a more dangerous place and a more unequal place and a more unhealthy place, it's the people that have to begin to mobilize. The governments are not our friends. And the governments are not going to help us. And it goes against, in a sense, what those of us at my age, at least, learned in civics class. You know, that you elect the governments and the governments represent you and you go to Washington and meet your representative. And that the governments should lead. In other words, we give them a mandate, we give them power, and they should be able to lead. And I think what we've all discovered over the years, and certainly as we get into the different crises that we're really in today, is that the government is a hindrance rather than a leader. And in fact, governments follow. One of the pins that I saw in one of our rallies, it stayed in my mind. It said, when the people lead, the leaders follow. And I really think that's the case. So, as we're working in Israel-Palestine, our organization, on this issue, we're really trying to connect up with other organizations, and we're trying to impart a message that says, we have to be the catalysts. We have to be the ones that bring up the solutions. We have to be the ones that mobilize and change public opinion. And in the end, change is going to happen by trickling up, as opposed to Bush the father's idea or Reagan's idea of trickle down. In other words, only when we mobilize the grassroots, and I think we're doing that on the Israel-Palestine issue together with other issues, then will the politicians begin to take notice. So it's almost like scratching your ear like this. But that's, in a sense, what we have to do. So I see you as not an audience. I mean, I know a lot of you. But certainly as partners, because this is something we're in together. And I think also the Israel-Palestine conflict is a conflict that has the potential. It's not simply a localized conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, but it touches on all kinds of other issues, global, regional issues, energy, materialism, issues of human rights and international law, so that in a sense it itself is a catalyst for beginning to connect the dots. And I think I'm looking kind of what I call global Palestine. The idea that, on the one hand, there are people that have written, I'm writing now about it, the Palestinianization of Iraq. Thanks. The Palestinianization of Afghanistan, where Israel is exporting its occupation outwards. And you could almost say the Palestinianization of poor people in Portland, because certainly they're at the receiving end of technologies of control, many of which come out of the Palestinian experience. Or you might turn it around and talk about the Israelization of public safety in the United States. In other words, the idea that that really what's happening in Palestine is a microcosm of what's happening in the wider world. And in fact, the occupied territories are in many ways a laboratory in which Israel tests new weaponry, new tactics, not only of military. You know, today this is a coming together of the military, homeland security, and policing. So kinds of technologies that get very quickly into your own local community. I wrote an article a while ago that was entitled The Road from Fallujah, Gaza, and Nablus Leads to Your Door. In other words, don't think that what's happening far away in Palestine is simply happening to them far away. And it's good that we sit down, you know, as together as activists, but this really is only an issue that has to do with Palestinians and Israelis. In fact, the message that I try to bring is that this is impacting on your entire community, on your entire country, on the entire world, in a sense, these kinds of conflicts. And part of our responsibility is to help people connect the dots, to see the issues involved in Israel-Palestine, again, not as localized issues, but as global issues that connect up to the conflicts in the Middle East, to issues of human rights and to militarism, and that eventually come home here in Portland. So, you know, what I'm trying to do, you know, more and more in my talks, and I guess I'm feeling to some degree, you know, that we're having success in mobilizing public opinion. I think all of you and all of us together have played a great role in making this issue a global issue. I think the Palestine issue is certainly one of the main issues today in the world. But at the same time, we're in a very frustrating situation that I'll talk about tonight a little bit, in that we're sort of in between solutions. You know, it's a conflict in Israel and Palestine that's a global conflict. It's an urgent conflict, urgent to resolve, and yet we don't have a clear direction in terms of where we're going. So part of what I want to talk about tonight is to sort of sharpen that analysis, to see what's going on the ground and politically, and then to begin to help us begin to think about solutions, because, and I'll talk about this, in the view of myself and my organization, the two-state solution is gone. In other words, the solution that had been the default solution all these years, and that on paper is accepted by the United States, is gone. And I'll show you in a minute why I say that. And therefore, we're going to have to start thinking of new options, and try to begin to mobilize around them. So let me begin by kind of laying out what we call the realities on the ground in Israel-Palestine, and then we'll talk about where we're going with this whole thing. Because in a sense, you know, if we're going to be actors, I mean, the first thing politicians will ask of us is, all right, what do you want? What's your ask? Where are you going? We have to know where we're going. And to some degree, we're in a transition now, and I don't think we really know where we're going. So the focus of what I'm saying is, where are we headed in Israel-Palestine? Peace, apartheid, or warehousing, that I'll talk about, and then with the idea of different scenarios and different possibilities. So this is a map of where we are. The map on the left is the two-state solution, the way it's conceptualized, and this is the solution that the international community has pursued since 1967, including the United States. The idea that there should be a state of Israel that's on 78% of historic Palestine, and a Palestinian state alongside in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza on the other 22% of the country. It's not a fair solution. It's not a just solution. But it's a solution that was accepted by the Palestinians about 25 years ago. In 1988... in Algiers, the PLO formally and publicly accepted the two-state solution. So we often hear about Barak's generous offer. We don't only hear about it, we get beaten over the head by it, that the Arabs never responded to. But we very seldom hear about the Palestinians' generous offer. As a matter of fact, some people like Edward Said thought it was too generous. The idea that that a colonized people like the Palestinians would actually give up political claim to 78% of their country. And yet that's what the PLO did, what the Palestinians did in 1988. So that the two-state solution is a solution accepted by not only the United States and the international community, but it was a solution accepted by the Palestinians themselves, their leadership, the PLO leadership, at a time when the PLO really did represent all the Palestinians. And in 2002, the Arab League, in what's called the Arab Peace Initiative, formally, unanimously, also accepted the two-state solution. And basically said to Israel at that time, if you relinquish the occupied territories, we'll not only make peace with you, but we'll integrate you into the region. I think little knowing that that's sort of Israel's nightmare is to be, Israel sees itself as a kind of a Singapore, and it would much rather be integrated into the EU than into the Arab League. But from the Arab point of view, at least, that was a generous offer. So in a sense, we have a situation where there is a solution that's agreed upon. The two-state solution is a solution of the international community, of the Palestinians, of the Arab League. As a matter of fact, according to the polls, up to 70% of Israeli Jews accept the idea of the two-state solution. And yet, I would argue that it's dead, that it's gone, because there's one party that never accepted it, and that's the Israeli government. Whether it's a Likud government or a Labor government, or in the case of Olmert, a Kadima government, no Israeli government ever accepted the idea of a two-state solution. On the contrary, what Israeli governments all did, and the Labor governments did it more vigorously than the Likud, was to build settlements and to create what we call facts on the ground. So that today, I think the reality is the map on the right. And that is Palestinians being locked, I'll show this a little bit more in detail in a second, into what we call areas A and B and Gaza. About maybe 15% of historic Palestine. And in a sense, I would argue it's worse than apartheid. It's a kind of warehousing, a permanent imprisonment of Palestinians, that this is where Israel is going, and this is, in fact, the reality on the ground. Now, how do I get there? I mean, many of you have heard me talk before about the matrix of control, so I won't dwell on this too much. But Israel has set over the occupied territories a matrix of control. The idea being that with all the vagaries of negotiations, maybe you'll get a president one day of the United States who's critical of Israel or who tries to put pressure on Israel. It hasn't happened, but maybe. Maybe there'll be geopolitical changes that will change. In other words, we can't rely simply on negotiations to nail down Israeli control over the entire country, over the, what we call the land of Israel. So that Israel set out in 1977, especially with the election of Begin, to systematically create facts on the ground that were so massive and so irreversible that they would simply preclude any outcome of negotiations that threatened Israeli control. In other words, it doesn't matter if you're in the Oslo negotiations or if you remember Annapolis negotiations or all the other weird kind of situations that emerged. The facts on the ground are really what determined the parameters of what was possible. And over all these years, Israel has created not only a matrix of control that's been effective in pacifying the Palestinians, but that I would argue is being exported today to other parts of the world. I would say that the matrix of control, with the structures it has, the tactics, the administrative mechanisms, and the weaponry, is being exported not only to war zones in different parts of the world, but is also being exported to cities like Portland through police forces and homeland security agencies. In other words, one thing I'd suggest is we look at the occupied territories really not as occupied anymore. Of course, Israel has always denied that there was an occupation. Israel has always said this is the land of Israel, and therefore there's no occupation because you can't occupy your own country, and therefore international law like the Fourth Geneva Convention does not apply. But at the same time, what Israel has succeeded in doing to a large degree is normalizing the situation, downplaying the military, because the whole point is that this is normal administration and it's not occupation. We enmesh the Palestinians in a web of administrative rules, bureaucratic rules, regulations, laws, planning, zoning, and that takes the place of the military. And then when you get a population pacified to the necessary degree, because Israel did use the army in cases, the last great, except for Gaza in 2006, before that you had a Operation Defensive Shield in 2002 in the West Bank. And those operations, from an Israeli point of view, did their job. They pacified they broke the resistance of the Palestinians. And then the whole governing of Palestinians has become really a police matter. So in a sense, Israel has developed here, if you look at the occupied territories again as a laboratory, it's developed a model of control and pacification that can be carried out through policing. And yet millions of restive people are kept under control, which is a model that's very useful when it's applied to other parts of the world, and especially when you have the aggressive neoliberal capitalism that we have today in this country and other places, where you can expect more and more impoverishment and more inequality, and the young people have less and less opportunities, and the poor people become more and more criminalized. The criminalization of being poor, then you need those mechanisms of control, and so in a sense the world looks to Israel as a model, not only of weaponry. When you stamp combat tested on your weaponry, that gives you an edge in the market. You know, the Portland police can use a kind of a taser, can use some kind of a device that's been tested. In Gaza, you know it's reliable, it's effective, right? And in a sense, Israel. What I'm saying is that the matrix of control is something that's exportable as well. So we have to look at the occupation again, not simply as a localized matter, not simply as an occupation, but as kind of a laboratory. And therefore, the matrix of control is this model of control and pacification that goes beyond the military. In other words, it's not based on force. You have the use of force if you want it. But that it's based on enmeshing people within a geography and a bureaucratic, a Kafkaesque reality in which they're neutralized and can't move. So just for those of you that aren't so familiar with the terrain, I'll just point out a couple of the elements of the matrix of control. One is the fragmentation of territory. The West Bank, I mean, Gaza out here is a cage. Now it's a little better because Egypt has started to open the border in a very limited sort of a way. But nevertheless, for most Gazans, it's a cage. And they can't get in and out. And they don't have the food and so on. So you have Gaza over here, but in the West Bank, the territory has been fragmented into what we call areas A, B, and C. And area A are these darker brown areas around the major population centers that are supposedly under full Palestinian control. This is where the Palestinian Authority, on paper at least, has sovereignty. Israel is not supposed to come in, is not supposed to interfere, although we know that Israel, in fact, comes in at will. And in fact, these little tiny islands are all surrounded by Israeli territory. There's no contiguity of territory, and obviously each of these little islands isn't viable, isn't self-sustaining, and therefore they're really kind of little cells, prison cells within a wider territory. But that's Area A, which is 18% of the occupied territories. And then you've got the lighter blue, the lighter brown, that are Area B, that that extend out to some degree from Area A, and that's another 22% of the occupied territories, in which the Palestinian Authority has civil control, but Israel has security control. So that what we might say is that after all these years of negotiations, all the Palestinians eked out of Israel was, if we take A and B together, 40% of 22% of historic Palestine. And that fragmented into all these little islands. And then Israel has built in Area C, which is all the gray area and the pink areas around A and B. Area C, the 60% of the West Bank that's under full Israeli control, has built more than 200 settlements and moved more than 500,000 Israelis into these occupied territories, of which we include East Jerusalem, even though it's been annexed by Israel as part of the occupied territories. So that the territory is fragmented, the Palestinians are surrounded by settlements. And another element that we don't usually take into account is infrastructure. Because again, infrastructure seems so neutral, so almost technical, that you don't really think about it. But the infrastructure is just as crucial, obviously, as the settlements, because you have to get from one place to another, and it opens up areas for settlement, for Israeli settlement, that otherwise Israelis wouldn't live in. So that you have the construction of about 28 major highways throughout the West Bank, connecting the settlements into Israel. And more and more, as Israel builds separate little roads for Palestinians, these highways are becoming exclusively for Israeli use. In other words, it's an apartheid system of highways. And what's important here is that it also breaks, you know, the idea of the two-state solution was a Palestinian state next to the state of Israel. But by building a lot of east-west highways, you break that north-south axis of one next to the other, and you reconfigure the country in a way that, in a sense, the West Bank that used to be over there is now in the center of a greater reconfigured Israel and cannot be detached. I mean, there is no more discrete territory. I would argue there's no more East Jerusalem. It just doesn't exist as an urban entity. And there really is no more West Bank. So the basic elements that would go into the two-state solution are gone from that point of view. And then you've got these pink areas that are the settlement blocks. These are the large settlement blocks that Israel wants to keep. And here's where you have to understand codes in order to understand what's happening, and especially the American position. Can we get the next slide? This is a letter, you know, we tend to forget. If you picked up Obstacles to Peace, our book, you'll find this in there, because there's all kinds of things that have happened along the way over the last 45 years or so that we've forgotten, but that are still really relevant. One of them is a letter that George Bush wrote to Sharon in 2004 that has become American policy. And you can't understand the dynamics today and the Obama government's relation to Israel and to the conflict without referring back to this, and I'll tell you why. Because in, go back, I don't know, one more. in the two-state solution idea, the borders were
either the 1967 borders,
or these borders are really the 1949 armistice lines.
When the war in 1948 ended, there was a ceasefire. It was never a peace agreement.
And these were the ceasefire lines, or the armistice lines.
And these have become the basis over the years of the two-state solution. And these are the lines, even though they don't really have international legality to them, these are the lines that the Palestinians have accepted as the lines of the two-state solution.
So then over the years, one more slide. Like I said, Israel has built not only settlements, but a new concept that's called settlement blocks.
And in fact, this is a map that we've done. As far as I know, it's the only map that exists. In other words, not the Israeli public, the American public, no one has ever seen a map of settlement blocks. Nobody knows that there's 3 blocks, 10 blocks, 5 blocks. But these are the basic elements that constitute both the Israeli and the American approach to any peace. So we would argue there's 7 settlement blocks. You know, these pink areas that are the areas that Israel wants to keep no matter what.
There's this what's called the Jordan Valley block in here. And the Jordan Valley settlements are here along a ridge. That's why they're a little bit away from the Jordan River,
because there's a ridge and then it falls like that. And that ridge is strategic.
And Israel has said, Netanyahu said in his address to a joint session of Congress in May 2011, he said, we will never, ever give up the Jordan Valley. So that this is one settlement block here that then controls the border with Jordan and controls all the water of the Jordan River. Now, that's not much of a river in Oregon. Here you'd call it a creek, if that. But in our part of the world, it's a major source of water.
You've been listening to a lecture by the director and co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Jeff Halper. And you're tuned to One Land, Many Voices on KABU Community Radio at 100.7 FM in Corvallis, 91.9 FM in Hood River, 90.7 FM in Portland, and naturally also streaming live on demand at KABU.fm. We're coming up on a membership drive here at KABU, so please, if you're enjoying this program, if you value this kind of presentation and discussion, please call in to renew your membership or head over to the KABU website at kabu.fm and click on the tip jar, the Donate Today jar in the upper right-hand corner of our homepage. Now, also coming up Wednesday on October 10th at 8:30 p.m., there's a film showing here in Portland, a very important film, 5 Broken Cameras. That's the title of the film, 5 Broken Cameras. This is part of the Northwest Film Center's film series, Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film. 5 Broken Cameras is the story of Imad Bernat, a farmer from the Palestinian village of Bela'in, a village in occupied Palestine, which famously chose nonviolent resistance when the Israeli army started to displace its people from their land to make room for Jewish-Israeli settlers. Imad Bernat buys his first camera in 2005 to document the birth of his 4th son, Gabriel, but soon comes to document this struggle against dispossession. Over the course of the film, Imad becomes the peaceful videographer of an escalating struggle as olive trees are bulldozed, lives are lost, and a wall is built to segregate the ever-expanding Israeli settlements. 5 Broken Cameras is an award-winning film that is not to be missed. 5 Broken Cameras. Again, that's showing on Wednesday, October 10th at 8:30 p.m. at the Witzel Auditorium at the Portland Art Museum, and that's at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in downtown Portland. The film's sponsored by Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. For more information, you can go to the Northwest Film Archives website at nwfilm.org. And now back to our presentation with Jeff Halper from last Saturday evening at the First Unitarian Church, also speaking about land dispossession and struggle in Israel-Palestine.
And all the water, 100% of the water, is controlled by Israel. Then you've got what's called the Ariel Block. See, this is the city of Ariel in the center that cuts the West Bank east and west and creates what we call in Israel, this is the terminology we use, cantons. So there's a Palestinian canton in the north that could conceivably be turned into one canton of a Palestinian Bantustan, or state, if you'd like to use that word. Then you've got a third block coming down this way. If you can see the little laser. It's not karaoke exactly, but you can see it. That connects the Ariel block to the greater Jerusalem area. This is the Modi'in block, because right here Israel is building a city called Modi'in that straddles the green line that's being built as the largest city in Israel. It's intended eventually to be larger than Tel Aviv. And it creates then a whole urban block here between Jerusalem that used to be very marginal. Jerusalem used to be at the end of the road, a very poor place. Now it's a part of this urban block that extends from Israel through the West Bank. Jerusalem itself is being transformed into a region. So there's three settlement blocks that make up what we call Greater Jerusalem. There's the Givat Ze'ev block here, Ma'ale Adumim over here, and the Etzion block down here that, again, divide the West Bank in half and control the Palestinians' greatest resource, which is Jerusalem. The World Bank estimates that 40% of the Palestinian economy revolves around Jerusalem because that's where tourism is, which is by far the largest potential Palestinian industry. You might have a little country that's dry and doesn't have much water and so on, but if you have Jerusalem and Bethlehem in it, it's not a bad... Those aren't sort of bad resources to begin to build something on. So the settlement blocks then isolate and cut that economic heart out of any Palestinian state. And finally, there's a seventh settlement block that comes up from the south to Hebron, the Jewish community in Hebron, that comes up this way. I think this is untenable. Hebron is like Gaza. And that could be given up. But nevertheless, then you see there's a canton created in the center, a canton created in the south, and then Gaza. So that the settlement blocks become very important. Okay. Come 2004, which is already, 8 years ago. So a lot has happened over the last 8 years. Bush sends a letter to Sharon. And he says this. As part of a final, I won't get it, this agreement, Israel must have secure and recognized borders. I don't know why Palestine can't have secure and recognized borders, but okay. Now, this is the key sentence. In light of new realities on the ground, okay, what does the American government call the settlement blocks? Does it call them settlement blocks? Does it call them settlements? Does it call them places in occupied territories? How does it refer to them? You see, the new realities on the ground include already existing major Israeli population centers. In other words, an existing major Israeli population center, they don't mean Tel Aviv. This is what they call the large settlements in the settlement blocks in the West Bank. So it's a whole term that's been sanitized. There's no reference to West Bank, to occupation, to settlements, to anything. So in light of these new realities on the ground, already existing major Israeli population centers, it is unrealistic to expect that the outcome of final status negotiations will be a full and complete return to the armistice lines of 1949. And all previous efforts to negotiate have come to that conclusion. In other words, at exactly the same moment that the United States and Bush are pushing what was called the Roadmap Initiative, that was trying to pursue a two-state solution based on the 1967 borders, Bush was writing a letter saying these borders don't mean anything because it's unrealistic to expect that those will be the borders given the demographic changes on the ground. Okay. Now, that wasn't only a Bush letter. This letter was reaffirmed by virtually unanimous resolutions of the House and the Senate, of which I'm sure your representatives in 2004 voted for. I mean, with the exception of, you know, Dennis Kucinich and maybe Ron Paul and a few members of the Black Caucus, it was absolutely unanimous, saying that, yes, this is American policy. And that's why when you talk about settlement freezes, Israel continues to build in those pink settlement blocks, because it says the settlement blocks have been accepted by the United States as permanently a part of Israel. They're not to be negotiated. And therefore, if we continue to build in East Jerusalem, or in Maale Adumim, or in Ariel, or in Hebron, we're not violating either the roadmap that calls for an end to settlement construction, or any settlement freeze that we've agreed upon with the United States and the Palestinians, because these are in already existing population centers that will permanently be a part of Israel. Now, how does that figure in? If we go back now to last May, May of 2011, when you have this weird week where Netanyahu is invited to speak by the Republicans to a joint session of Congress, and he's sandwiched in between two speeches of Obama, President Obama. The first speech, if you remember, and you might recall this, was in the State Department, where Obama says, the position of the United States is that negotiations are based on the 1967 borders. Everybody, and he even said, I almost quote word for word, everybody knows that that's going to be the eventual resolution of this conflict. Okay. Well, the Israeli lobby went nuts. And AIPAC and all the pro-Israel, what about the Bush letter? What about the settlement blocks? What about the existing population centers? Okay. So if you recall, Netanyahu speaks before the joint session of Congress, gets something like 48 standing ovations in a 20-minute talk. Even the Israeli press, even the Israelis ridiculed the American Congress. You know, one of the Israeli newspapers said it looked like the North Korean Congress. You know? Okay, then 2 days after that, like 4 days after his talk in the State Department, Obama appears before AIPAC. And what he says before AIPAC, and look it up tonight, you get the wording more, but this is what he said. What I said a couple days ago in the State Department about the 67 borders being the basis of negotiations, I stand by that. That is the American position. But what do we mean by 67 borders? We mean 67 borders that take into account the major demographic changes that have happened over the years. You see? So in a sense, Obama has not only adopted the Bush letter, but has now formally made it American policy. And that's why, basically, I would argue the two-state solution is gone. Because it's not only the facts on the ground now that are in place, but the American administration, which is and actually Congress, which is the only thing that counts for Israel, recognizes these facts on the ground, again, as those parameters that determine the contours of any possible peace. So the idea, I mean, it's already been decided by the American government that the settlement blocks are not to be negotiated. So whatever we negotiate with the Palestinians will be all the territory outside of these major settlement blocks, which, you know, it's not a recipe for a viable sovereign state. And then, I'm going to finish in a minute, just to add to that, of course, What Israel has done then over the last 10 years or so is to build the wall. What we call, what Israel, we call it the apartheid wall, and so does Israel. Because we use the word apartheid officially in Israel, we simply say it in Hebrew rather than Afrikaans. Apartheid means separation or separateness of populations, apart. The official name of our policy towards the Palestinians is Hafrada, H-A-F-R-A-D-A, which means apartheid, separation. The official name of the wall is not the security barrier. In other words, even though Israel sells it as a security barrier against terrorism, in fact, the official name of the wall is the separation barrier. And if you look at the root of the wall, you can see it's clear. It basically comes to confirm in concrete the cantons that we've carved out for the Palestinians. So if you see the line of the wall, it's clear. It hugs areas A and B. And all right, it gives some little parts of C. Some of these little tiny settlements will be removed and moved into the major settlement blocks. But basically, it hugs A and B, and when it hits the settlement block, the wall goes around it. You can't tell me the wall comes to here for security reasons. It's clear that it's on the one hand defining the contours of the cantons on the one hand, but also incorporating the settlement blocks on the other hand. And so that we have really, that's sort of the last fact on the ground that was imposed on the West Bank. And then, I'm not going to take time. I just wanted to show you at least the wall.
I think I'm doing that, right? Okay.
The wall is just, to give you a little tiny, so those of you that haven't been there, sense of what's happening on the ground. The wall is 26 feet high. Which means it's more than twice as high as the Berlin Wall was. You know, the Berlin Wall was 12 feet high. And this is 26 feet high. And it's five times longer than the Berlin Wall was. And the Berlin Wall was linear. You know, it cut Germany, not in half, but it went through Germany. This wall is... It encompasses thousands of Palestinians into cells. This, for example, is the city of Tul Karm. 70,000 people, completely surrounded by a wall, with one exit and entrance controlled by the Israeli army. And the wall does not separate Israelis from Palestinians, because Jews don't have a very positive association with walls. You know, we don't want to be fenced in. We don't want to be imprisoned. So the wall is built deep into Palestinian areas. It separates, it cuts Palestinian communities in half and separates Palestinians from Palestinians. So here's a grandmother in Bethlehem whose grandchildren live in Beit Jala with the wall coming through the center of the community. The wall even goes through high school courtyards. This is a high school in the town of Anata, near Jerusalem. So all of that then has created the situation in which you have basically a Bantustan emerging. And since the Palestinians will never accept apartheid, in a sense, the biggest danger is that we're moving towards warehousing. In other words, warehousing, I mean, everybody used to criticize me and Jimmy Carter and other people that use the word apartheid, you can't use the word, and the people, well, there's actually something worse than apartheid, and that's warehousing. Because apartheid, first of all, at least gives lip service to the idea that there's two sides, there's an apart. You know, South Africa used to talk about separate development. That was the basis of, well, here you don't even pretend that there's another set. There's inmates, basically. There's people without rights that we don't want to see that are locked into ghettos behind walls, and it's static. In other words, there's no pretense of a political process. Warehousing, the word warehousing, you know, comes from the prison world of the United States, where the United States has 6% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. And they're warehoused. They're out of sight, out of mind. No, you know, certainly in the presidential election, prison reform is not one of the major issues. They're gone. And that's the idea of pacification. And Israel says we can do this not only to the Palestinians, but we can do this to the two-thirds of humanity. Now here, there's a since we're at a church, let's just talk for 1 second about theology. I think warehousing is a theological concept. I mean, this is where the capitalist world, supported by the models, the matrices of control that Israel and other countries develop, and corporations develop, this is warehousing is the future of two-thirds of humanity that has been completely written off and will be warehoused. Most of the continent of Africa, a lot of what we call the third world, the people will never ever be consumers, they'll never be educated, they'll never have a role, they'll be warehoused, like the Palestinians. And therefore, the way we warehouse the Palestinians becomes relevant to how the capitalist world in general warehouses other people. And that has to do with another concept that I think is theological, which is surplus humanity. That's who you're warehousing. The Palestinians are considered to be surplus humanity. Who needs them? There's no place for them. There's an Israel, and there's a Jordan, and there's a Syria, and the Palestinians don't fit in anywhere. They're an irrelevant, a surplus population. And in fact, that's a word that corporations have used towards the peoples of the third world, surplus humanity. So in a sense, you've got, I think, a fundamental global, theological, not just political, legal, human rights conflict here. You have almost a theological issue here of people being defined as surplus humanity and then warehoused. So just to end, I think that we have, obviously this is unacceptable. We have to fight against warehousing, realizing that if we're fighting the issue of the Palestinians, in many ways we're fighting again that larger fight. And it's and I think that's the part of the idea, part of the task of the BDS movement is to help people connect the dots. That we're not only sanctioning what's happening, you know, Israel's policies and companies that are profiting from the occupation, but in a sense, there's a wider BDS movement, if you want to put it that way, because if you follow the threads out, you get back to the poor people and the dissident people and the 99% in your own community that are being controlled in the same sort of a way. So it's very important for us, I think, not only to resolve this conflict, and to do that, we're going to have to work against governments. I mean, the American government and other core governments of the capitalist world have an invested interest in this. This is their model. And if this can be broken, if in fact we can defeat the occupation, we can defeat the military, we can defeat the matrix of control, that sets up a challenge for people all over the world that might think that they can defeat this system of warehousing. So that we have to be the ones that connect the dots, and we have to be the ones that come up with solutions. And on this I want to end. One of the problems we have today in this conflict is that we don't have an agreed-upon solution. The two-state solution is gone. Whether or not people accept it or not, I think, first of all, for those of you who have been there, it takes 20 minutes to figure out it's gone once you've been there, but the maps help as well. I don't see any way of reversing. It's, on the contrary, I mean, the Obama administration has reaffirmed its commitment to these demographic realities on the ground. So that the two-state solution is gone, but we're not at a one-state solution yet. And I think partly the Palestinians are holding back, maybe out of exhaustion, which is certainly understandable. In other words, the idea being, look, we've worked all these years, 50 years it took us to get the two-state solution accepted by the international community, on the agenda. Oh, God, what do we have to do now? Start all over again with a one-state? You know, just people don't have the mental, and certainly that's a part of the strategy, is to exhaust people so that they just don't have the energy to keep going. And so in a sense, you know, what we're trying to do in ICAD is gently to prod us all, knowing we're all tired and frustrated, to begin to think about solutions. If the two-state solution is gone, if today there's no political process, then let's use this limbo, use this stuckness we're in, this space, to begin to think of ways out. And what I want to leave you with, I don't have a solution. We would have no problem with a one-state solution. In fact, we issued a kind of a statement in the last couple of weeks calling on everyone to begin to think about a one-state solution. But we're holding back in a way because we're following the Palestinians. We think it's the Palestinians' prerogative to tell us what the solution is, not us to tell them what it is. And so we're pushing and prodding and bringing up ideas, and we're willing to consider a one-state solution, certainly, but we're just holding back from actually endorsing it until we get more Palestinian support. But what I can say is that in my view, and not everybody that accepts a one-state solution agrees with this, this needs a lot of negotiation and discussion. I think there are five or six essential elements that have to go into any peace. At least we can begin to block out what has to go into a peace, even if we don't have all the details of what it looks like. And I think that if all these elements are present, it can work. Even a two-state solution could work if these elements are present. If any of these elements are missing, I don't care how good it looks on paper, the solution is not going to succeed. And that is, just in a word, a peace has to be inclusive. In other words, I think there's two peoples living in the country, and I think we have to begin, even if we talk about a democratic state emerging, there's, in a sense, it's a binational state. There's two peoples living there, and both of them have to be included in any peace process. It has to be economically viable, which precludes apartheid. It has to be, whatever the solution, it has to conform with human rights, international law, and UN resolutions. And that's very important, because Oslo failed partly because international law was taken out of the equation, because that's what levels the playing field. If international law applies, especially the Fourth Geneva Convention, the occupation crumbles by its own illegality. So that's an instrument that has to be used and exploited by the Palestinians. The refugee, obviously, there has to be the right of return. And not only that, but Israel has to acknowledge what it did for any kind of a healing process to take place. I think there has to be a regional approach. I won't get into that right now, but I think the approach has to be one that includes the entire region and not only Israel-Palestine. And I've written about the idea of a Middle East economic confederation, something like the common market was in Europe 30 years ago of Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. I think stepping back and looking at it regionally opens up possibilities for peace and development that don't exist if we're only looking at one state, two states all the time. And finally, of course, the security of all the actors has to be addressed. So just the last sentence, you know, that brings up then different scenarios that exist for us that we have to begin to preclude and eliminate or begin to adopt. In other words, a viable two-state solution is certainly a solution, but I think it's gone. But not everybody is there. Certainly J Street isn't there. A lot of people, even in our community that's more critical, still believe the two-state is possible. So it's in the pot, let's say. It's acceptable if it can be done and if the Palestinians agree to it, if they get a real state. The Palestinian Authority is still committed to the two-state solution. Or you get apartheid, which is where we are today, And at some point it gets nailed down into a kind of a warehousing, because Israel wouldn't want to institutionalize an apartheid system. So it'll just let the status quo keep going, so you have de facto warehousing, which is unacceptable. Or there could be a one-state solution, and that could be a democratic state or a binational state. One state is still a complicated matter that has to be worked out. And then another option, or that might follow from this, is a regional confederation. So I think we have to begin a discussion between ourselves and our Palestinian partners in terms of where are we going. That discussion, I think, is urgent and has to take place. And so we're working at least to try to begin to block out those elements, how it would look, so we can begin to revitalize our movement by suggesting to governments a doable, just, and durable peace. So I'll leave it at that.
That was Jeff Halper, director and co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition, speaking here in Portland last Saturday evening. The full presentation, including the question and answer session, will be available up on YouTube and Vimeo in a few weeks, hopefully. And if you'd like to know when that might be, or if you'd like a copy, you can write to pdxjustice@riseup.net. That's pdxjustice, one word, @riseup.net. And that brings us to the end of another edition of One Land, Many Voices. I'm your host, Will Seaman. Wael and I will be back next month, fourth Friday of each month, 9 a.m., here on Community Radio KBOO. Thanks for tuning in.